Hey everybody, this is Brian coming at you from late 2022. You're about to listen to one of the original episodes of the Internet History Podcast, a project I started way back in 2014. It eventually became a book called How the Internet Happened, From Netscape to the iPhone, written by me, but these are the original chapters and interviews I did for that book. So here you have all the original oral history interviews, the original players of the internet era in their own words. You'll get hours more detail and stories here than I was able to even fit in the book. If you like this podcast, buy the book, but also the podcasts stand on their own. Almost 300 hours of original source material of internet history. They've been downloaded about 3 million times over the years. And if you like what you hear here, search and subscribe to What I Do Today, the Tech Meme Ride Home podcast, a daily tech news podcast I've been doing since 2018. Basically, the Tech Meme Ride Home podcast is the history of the internet every day in real time.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Welcome to the Internet History Podcast. I'm your host, Brian McCullough. Everyone knows Karen Wickrey because she's one of those classic connectors. Once we finally got in touch, I wasn't surprised to learn that we knew about half a dozen of the same people that we had never even remotely crossed paths ourselves. Karen knows everyone because she's popped up Zelig-like in a bunch of interesting places over the course of tech history over the last 30 years or so. Early tech journalism, Planet Out, early Google employee, early blogger, early tweeter, editorial director at Twitter. Karen has a great book out that you should read, explaining how to do what she does so successfully, called Take the Work Out of Networking, An Introvert's Guide to Making Connections That Count. Please enjoy this especially wide-ranging conversation with the great Karen Wickrey. Karen Wickrey, thanks for coming on the Internet History Podcast.
Oh, thank you for having me, Brian.
Well, it's been a couple years coming. I think Cindy's been trying to get this in for a while now. But
yeah,
the simplest way to start for these sorts of things is either like education or whatever. But also sometimes it's interesting to get people's entree into computing generally.
Uh-huh.
So sometimes I ask, what was your first machine that was yours? Or what was your first... Because if you go back far enough to actually that you couldn't have a machine that was yours, what was your first experience with computing generally?
It was in 1984, and it was a K-Pro. I don't remember the model, but I had just moved to San Francisco to take a job at a nonprofit called Media Alliance, which was a membership organization of journalists. And I'd long been a typist. I'd been on many Selectrix and earlier machines. But the K-Pro was what was in the office of Media Alliance. And so I looked at this thing horrified, and I had to sort of learn my way around for some word processing. But ironically, the second machine I had, did not own, came less than a year and a half later when I was hired away from Media Alliance to join David Bunnell at PC World Magazine and Mac World Magazine. He founded those, and it was a private company called IDG, International Data Group. And that was, I mean, that opened a lot of doors, and so my first machine there was probably a Macintosh 128, maybe? Something like that. That was the entree.
This is mid-80s?
Yeah, it would have been 85 when I joined IDG.
And I think I saw on your LinkedIn that your job was to try to dial up new titles and things like that, but were they supposed to be tech titles?
Oh, yeah. This was all... So Bunnell is worth his own history. Sadly, he's no longer with us. But I learned this history very quickly when I went there, that he had been essentially a journalist and got interested in home computing, personal computing, because at the time this was the sort of liberating fact of life for lots of people. Everybody could be a publisher. And so he had started PC Magazine through a business deal that didn't end up being his. It went to Ziff Davis. But he started a rival, PC World, and that's when IDG stepped in to acquire him and them. So he explained to me his history had been with the MITS Altair 88 and Eddie Roberts and Ed, you know, that whole kind of earlier generation, which I knew nothing about. So I learned to appreciate the history very quickly.
Well, a couple of things. Put a pin in that you knew nothing about, but I think, I can't remember who I was talking to. It's worth pointing out to modern listeners that these were really sort of, you know, you think of the Engadgets and Gizmodos of the world today, and they're sort of consumer publications. And PC World and all these were kind of consumer, but they were more industry focused. And so it's not sort of like the gadgetry journalism as we would think of it today. It is some of that. There's a new machine. Here's what it can do. We'll give it a rating or that sort of thing. But it's also for throwing up ads. That's the only place where these tech companies can even advertise, essentially.
That's right. That's right. And in those days, there were many, many very small software companies. And within a year of my joining, David said, oh, you should come with me to Comdex. And I mean, my mind was blown. This was a big trade show in Las Vegas that preceded CES. But I remember thinking, it's only 1985, 1986. Where did this world come from with mm-hmm. this lingo that they already have adopted? You know, everybody's comfortable, you know, using, you know, these very odd terms. They've already got, you know, sort of a style and branding, and it's a million companies I never heard. Like, where did this spring from, you know? And of course I understand it was essentially a lot of small businesses and of course some of the big guys, most at that point IBM was probably the biggest, and Intel I suppose. Mm-hmm. But it was just a world unto itself. I felt like an anthropologist coming into this.
Well, so then that's the you don't have any nerd background necessarily, and steep learning curve for you to get involved in this sort of world, or is it exciting also at the same time?
It was exciting, and here's the thing. I've always been a pretty fast writer and editor. I've been in office environments for a long time, and before that I was in smaller businesses and academia and nonprofits, but I'd always been around offices, so I knew kind of that dynamic of how offices worked and how people work in offices. So the subject matter was a steep learning curve, and it just took me a while to sort of get used to the lingo and what was being talked about. But the sort of comforting thing was nobody was really an expert, or there were very few. Mm-hmm. There certainly weren't any really on the magazine staffs, because it had just sprung up in the previous, 5 years or less, as far as personal computing went. And yes, it was corporate, but
right.
What people were touting was you're going to have your own machine,
right?
And your own software. And so to me, it was, you know, kind of intriguing, partly because I'm a liberal arts person. And so I felt like I must be the last person to know about this stuff. Turned out that wasn't true.
No.
But it was a gradual learning curve, but I felt like I was learning along with other people.
But that does put you on this path to the world of PR marketing for tech, essentially. Or at least understanding those people and that world.
That, and also editorial. Mm. Because I was, I always felt close to the editors and the reporters on the magazines. Mm-hmm. I'd had, not really a journalism, I'd studied journalism. I'd always felt too timid to go into it myself, mm-hmm. frankly, when I was younger. But I always admired people who could write clearly and make sense of things. And that was actually a mission of the IDG magazines, predating Walt Mossberg a little bit, which was, mm-hmm. you know, this stuff is confusing and we're going to like make it simpler for you. And they did try. And I appreciated that. And I was, I learned a lot that way.
And please correct me if I jump around too much in the timeline here. Do you remember your first encounter with online? And I'm not even talking about the web. I'm talking about maybe BBSs or Prodigy, whatever.
I do, and it had to do with IDG and this David Bunnell's companies for this reason. So online, I mean, the first online I knew about was basically expensive, pay by the hour online. Partly that was because since Macworld magazine did some business with Apple, there was Apple Link. Mm-hmm. Apple Link, I believe, was a product of GE. Mm-hmm. And so there were early discussions, I mean, 88, let's say, that I was in on that had to do with how can we make Macworld available on Apple Link and not piss off readers by making them pay for the minutes when the ads are up. Mm. Because it was $35 an hour.
Yeah.
And everybody understood we can't charge people to look at the ads. The advertisers want to get in front of the readers or viewers. Mm-hmm. You know, how do we make that work? And we didn't figure this out at the time. I mean, Apple Link was such... I mean, there can't have been more than 10,000-20,000 people on Apple Link. I mean, it must have been tiny.
Well, but then there's that weird, like, because GE goes off and does Genie.
Yes.
And then, but then also there's that weird connection that somehow that kept what would become AOL alive, because Steve Case made that deal with them, and then that kept them alive for a while before they spun that out into AOL.
But that, anyway, that was my first, I felt like I barely understood, because I understood the notion of the content being online, but in these kind of private systems, and it, somewhere in that same period, I did get MCI mail. I tried them all. I tried CompuServe and Prodigy and Wow. You remember Wow and eWorld. I actually reviewed eWorld for some long dead computer publication. But anyway, I got very interested in those when they became available. So that must have been 90, 91. Something like that. But anyway, my first memory is of this Apple Link thing.
And how do you, is it sort of you just, you're around and available, so you stumble into doing the journalism and doing the columns and things like that, just sort of accidentally, or?
Maybe accidentally, maybe because I was interested in these services. I did know how to write. I knew people who knew I knew how to write. Mm-hmm. And as people spun out of the magazines, as I did myself, 1989, David Bunnell and the other founders' contract was up with IDG. So they left, and that left that sort of corporate layer, including me, out of a job. Mm. And I didn't want to align myself with any one of the magazines. I liked having this kind of horizontal role across them, and there wasn't really that role anymore. So I started consulting and doing some freelance writing. And by then, you know, more computer magazines were out there, and that's probably when I would review something like eWorld.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, but you start to have a regular column around, like, what, 93, 94?
Well, it would have been, it had to be 94, 95,
okay.
I think, because I was editing... Some of the writing got me into editing books for computer book publishers. And so I did one that was an early guide to Netscape Navigator. Mm-hmm. And I remember this trade press was Ziff Davis Press. And I remember the editor said to me one day, "We don't want to miss out on this World Wide Web thing. So would you be interested in doing a book on the web?" So this would have been 94, and again, I was by now independent. Mm-hmm. And I said, "Yeah, sure." And immediately I thought, I need to have a technical partner, because I don't really understand the web, you know, what makes the web But yes, the opportunity to do a book, sure. So I believe this was maybe the second of the consumer guides that came out.
Right, because who was it that did...
Ventana Press was one that I know.
Uh-huh. And then the guys that got bought by AOL that had the first commercial website, I talked to them. I can't remember the name of the company right now. Because the reason they did a website is they were trying to do a guide to the web. And so they created a directory and they threw that online. And then they threw ads up after that. Well, I'll try to put that in the show notes as well, because I know that we talked to someone about that.
Yeah.
But actually, it's worth pointing out, because I actually have the book in front of me, Atlas to the World Wide Web. And of course, it has a CD inside it, which a lot of books did at that time, because again, as I've spoken to with other people, there was also, in this time, there was the whole CD-ROM boom, and that was supposed to be the next big thing. And then
That's
it sort of gets muddied because all of the energy of CD-ROMs and some of the talent that are producing these go in as soon as the web takes off and go to the web.
That's right. That's right. And this publisher, Ziff Davis, thought, I mean, they did basically software update books. They made their money off of, here's version 1.0, next year there's version 2.0, you know. And so this to them was, you know, kind of a little bit of more of a consumer departure. This is essentially a book of reviews, very short reviews of websites. And I remember in compiling it, I thought, I mean, I do believe I must have looked at the first 1,000 websites.
Right, because that was possible.
Yeah,
that was possible. That's what, like, Jerry Yang says, is he's like, you could still, in an afternoon, visit the entire web.
Yeah.
If you're in 1994, certainly, early 94.
You could if your ISDN connection was up.
Well, and it's... You know, flipping through it, like, these are great. Like, when I wrote the book, it's like, well, what was there in 1994 that interested people? And it's sort of an amorphous thing, because it's sort of everything and nothing at the same time. So, like, here's the whole frog project, which I mentioned in the book. You could dissect a virtual frog online, and, like, the National Institutes of Health are online, the IEEE is online, but what is, like, Le Cordon Bleu? It's a fancy... No, Le Cordon Bleu comes to the rescue. It's a... Oh, the menus from the world-famous cooking school in Paris. So you see what I'm saying?
It's very random.
It's almost like no one knows quite what to do with the web. At the same time, everyone is like, oh, my God, we can do anything with the web.
And that's right. Like, and the first, there's a big theme, I think, in this book. A lot of things came out of academia.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So there were either directories, or they would have done, you know, something based on some academic project or other. Because, of course, they were online early. In fact... Right after I left, as one backtrack here, when I left IDG in 1989, I fell pretty quickly into doing a consulting project for Addison Wesley, the big book publisher. And they were in the midst of, strangely, they had one academic journal, and it was Stephen Wolfram's Mathematica journal.
Mm-hmm.
And so they wanted to make because they published, I guess, the Mathematica software and guide or something, they wanted to make a periodical, the Mathematica Journal.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't, I mean, this little division that was doing this, they had no experience with periodicals because books.
Mm-hmm.
So they hired me to put together a plan for what would be needed to make a periodical, which I knew enough about by then to say, well, here, you know, for them it was quarterly, but the same idea as a magazine, sort of like, here's what you need for someone to do, look after circulation and you know, someone for production and so on. And so I worked with them for maybe a year or more, flew to Champaign, Urbana, met with Stephen Wolfram. I mean, you know, their academics' idea of a periodical was very different than my idea of a magazine, I must say. However, that was maybe one of my first inklings about the internet at large, because I remember talking to the academics who were on the, you know, connected to Mathematica. They were at Princeton or they were at University of Illinois. And I remember saying to them, what's your email address? You know, or they'd give me a card. And I could not understand how it could just be princeton.edu. I'd say, no, what service is it? Is it MCI mail? Is it, you know, Prodigy? What is it?
Uh-huh.
How could it just be an address?
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm sure they looked at me like, no, you know, they couldn't sort of make the leap to say, because of we're academia, we have access to this thing through DARPANET or whatever. I just couldn't understand how you could just have an address.
So maybe I should ask a question about the process of doing the book, because again, what we're describing with the Atlas to the World Wide Web is this is a thing that is necessary as people are like, what is this internet thing?
Yes.
What can I do on it? The search engines, while they exist at the time, they don't work very well. And so you literally, it's a moment in time where you do need a guide to even know what is possible.
That's right.
So like, how did you find what was possible and curate it and put it together in this book?
Well, there was enough. I guess because I had some general awareness of the web coming up. Mm-hmm. In fact, during the making of this book, Mosaic changed its name to Netscape. Mm-hmm. And I remember arguing with the editors who were used to putting out annual books, mm-hmm. saying, we have to change the name, mm-hmm. and we have to change the logo. We have to capture the new Netscape logo. And they said, oh, we'll wait till next year. Mm-hmm. And I said, no, yeah. You cannot.
Yeah.
Right? This is how this thing goes. So the other person's name on the book is Bob Powell. He was a friend of mine who was an engineer at, I think, Industrial Light and Magic at the time. So I knew he would understand sort of they wanted a front-end piece about explaining the web. Unfortunately, they also loved spider imagery. This was big in the early days of the web. Mm-hmm. You had lots of graphics that mm-hmm. were just mm-hmm. so hokey. But anyway, Bob was the one. We negotiated to have 2 months of ISDN time, and we arranged for Pacific Bell to install it at his house so that he could be there to explain to the installer like how to do it, so that we had a relatively fast connection. Uh-huh. For me, I mean, I did all the reviewing just uh-huh. about. So for me to sit there and look up everything, that's a tangent. Sorry that I got off of that. But
no, that's the sort of stuff that I want to record. Okay, so I'm gonna stab in the dark here. Like my next question was to get towards Plan It Out, because if I, uh-huh. but if I'm missing something important, please interject here. Tom Riley's been on the show, so
right.
we've had the Planet Out story from his perspective. But tell me how this comes about. Was this too early to be AOL Greenhouse stuff? But was it a project that was involved with AOL at first? And
it was, and I was kind of side by side with him, but not involved in the very early development uh-huh. of Planet Out. He and I had run a small nonprofit called Digital Queers,
right.
And so that part of that, and that
when
was...
When did that start?
I want to say 93-ish, 94. Two things happened. The first one was because Tom in particular had a lot of connections through his working at Mac companies. Mac World Expo was a big, event in San Francisco. It used to be in Boston, too. And... So he wanted partly a social gathering, but he also thought of the notion of let's help these various gay and lesbian organizations, the national organizations around the country, get some decent computer equipment and software. His idea was go around the show and get some pledges of support and some hand-me-downs that were better than the hand-me-downs that not any nonprofit typically mm-hmm. had in those days, if they had anything. And so that was sort of phase one. And I must say a sort of motley collection of software and equipment came in that wasn't probably well suited to any one mm-hmm. organization. But somewhere in there very quickly came the AOL disks. And so then the notion was a bunch of us who would basically volunteer would go to the national conferences of some of these organizations and do training for the teams and the staffs of the organizations and give away AOL disks. Because AOL very early on seemed gay-friendly, mm. and they were chat rooms, but they were also sort of online communities of various types.
Yeah, yeah.
Can
I just ask a question? Because I've never considered that before. You had the sense that AOL was more friendly than, say, other services were?
Yes, and I think... I can't say exactly how this awareness came to be, but the woman who ran the AOL gay and lesbian community lived in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. Her screen name was Quirk. Mm. Her actual name was Michelle. I can't remember her last name. And she purposely kept herself as Quirk, as sort of a mm-hmm. slightly mysterious online presence.
Pseudonymous.
Yeah, but she ran, it was a super active group. And it was driving adoption of AOL mm-hmm. to some degree.
Yeah.
And Tom was already friendly with Steve Case and had various connections to him, and it was all pretty informal in those days. And so they had talked about it. I mean, Steve was aware of this, too. I think at the time, I mean, there's a long history of, I think, gay and lesbian people being online mm-hmm. Because it could be private, it could, you know, you could be anywhere and, right. You know, sort of try out new ideas for yourself. But AOL was at a point where it wanted adoption.
Yeah.
And in those heady days, you know, giving out discs, as Jan Brandt engineered, you know, became the thing. So DQ people would then go to these conferences and give away, you know, hundreds and hundreds of discs.
I think Tom and I spoke to that to a certain degree about not just there's a certain period where everyone has to learn how to live online, so that then at the time what would be considered marginal communities are sort of the pioneers in this, because it offers the ability to do that, to
right.
build community.
And to connect if you're in rural areas, to, you know, sort of try on a new notion of yourself, maybe you, or learn from people
exactly.
who are already there. Yeah.
So that learning I can have a different identity online, or I can craft a different sort of identity online than my offline identity.
You know, before the AOL disk, there was FidoNet, mm-hmm. which was created by Tom Jennings. Mm-hmm. And if I'm not mistaken, he's gay. Mm-hmm. And I sort of learned this history a little bit piecemeal and by osmosis, that once again there was the same kind of idea, or T-Star mm-hmm. Groups, I guess, Usenet groups, same thing, sort of came from this same era of sort of here were safe places to gather, right? And then Quirk and I'm sure the other services began to do this too, would have real life meetups mm-hmm. in different places, you know, in different cities and so on. I remember going to the one before the March on Washington in 1993 that was at a hotel off of DuPont Circle that was the AOL, whatever it was called. Maybe it was just the gay and lesbian group. I don't remember.
Yeah. Interesting. All right. Let's head back towards Plan It Out.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you know Tom, you're doing these digital queer
right.
groups and things like this, and so then how does that lead to the website and the community?
So Tom was developing this, and he had enlisted several talented young guys to do programming and development of it, Eric Mueller, Christian Williams, David Stazer, and he was really doing this on his own. I wasn't particularly involved in it. And I, you know, I didn't know where it was going to go, but I was continuing to do my freelance
consulting,
writing, and that's probably somewhere there is when I got one or two of these columns, and I was doing these roundups of websites and that sort of thing. And so anyway, he's developing it. It wasn't until they had gotten their funding from Sequoia and had hired, I guess, the CEO, John Huggett, when I then was interested in applying for a job, because then it was more real. It wasn't just my friend and his startup, and who knew how it was going to go, but it signified a more real thing, and it was an editorial job.
Okay, yeah.
It was executive producer of the site, which was essentially kind of the Uber managing editor of the thing.
So again, I would reference listeners' other episodes about like iVillage, the Nancy mm-hmm. Evans ones. So the concept is, for these early websites, everyone thinks it's like what AOL tried to do. We need to bring Cindy Smith over. We need to bring content from offline over to online.
Right.
And so the idea is to produce columns and articles and content and things like that.
That's right.
And that's what your job was?
Yes.
And writing and things like that. did a lot of people that I've talked to about this discover, well, no, people might come for the columns, but they stay for the other people and the chatting and the community and things like that?
Yes. I mean, at the time, I think those were all draws because there weren't a lot of magazines. I mean, paper magazines have complexities that online didn't, especially if you weren't out.
Right.
But in any case, not you might get magazines intermittently or late or something. So here was a place to have columnists and articles. The idea at the time was, you know, for people who didn't have enough gay anything in their life, like here was a whole lot of everything. Yeah, mm-hmm. And yes, community was a driver, but so was content, I would argue. And it was fun for me to find, pay very little, but I think we paid something, but we, you know, would pay for material. So it was fun to find sort of essentially young, unpublished, you know, writers. And I think we even got into cartoons and whatnot. Mm. So, yes, over time, I think the whole notion of community, I mean, it's changed a lot since. But at the time, content was a draw.
So this is 96, 97-ish?
96, 97, and I didn't last very long.
Right.
I think I was employed 6 months, and then John Huggett, the CEO, fired me because I was too loyal to Tom, who had been banished, and you know that whole story. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's Byte.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Do you go to Upside Next, or is there something else?
I did go to Upside Next.
Yeah, well, tell me the story, because one of the things that I did for the book is go to the actual library and find actual physical copies of things like Upside and Industry Standard.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. There's a bunch of stuff that's gone down the memory hole from this period especially. But, you know, the story of Upside and a couple other of these publications that I named is kind of the story of the bubble, because these are all publications that are trying to capture this energy.
Certainly so, Industry Standard, yeah.
Yeah, tell
Upside,
me.
Upside was a little earlier,
because it had started
known about
it. Right, yeah.
It was more, it was kind of the business of technology,
right.
The business side of technology. Not a bad thing
I think
to
the
cover.
First issues that I found were from like 93, maybe even 92.
It could be.
Yeah.
It was around a little earlier, as I think it was bi-monthly magazine, mm-hmm. maybe. It, independently published, I think. And I don't remember who the owners were at first. And the first editor that I'm aware of was a guy named Eric Nee. And he was known for very provocative, interesting Q&As with, mm-hmm. you know, executives and founders and whatnot.
Yeah.
Sort of some of the big names in tech at that time.
Which, again, it seems obvious today, but kind of wasn't at the time.
Right, it wasn't.
Yeah,
that's right.
Sort of entrepreneur porn culture.
Yeah.
Because, you know, everyone's like, sit down with me, tell me how you founded this company, and or also tell me what you're doing, what is the next thing. Like, that's the thing that struck me about finding those interviews, is it's like, well, this is like not something that was common.
No, and also they weren't founders. They may have been founders, but they were more like, you know, it would be like John Chambers at Cisco or Scott McNeely at Sun or something like that. Steve Case was a cover.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't like young bro founders, as we might now.
Because that wasn't the thing then either, right?
No, that's right. There weren't a lot of startups that got
dorm room startups.
Yeah, exactly. So I joined, so Upside had been around. By the time I joined, my old friend David Bunnell, who was on the board of Upside, had taken it over. There'd been some sort of change of management, I don't remember, but some of the original people behind it stepped away.
Mm-hmm.
And so David came in, installed a different editor named Richard Brandt, and Then he and I were still friendly and we're still talking, and he was interested in kind of shaking it up, and he said, I'd love to hire you to be the executive editor, which at that time meant, or in that place, meant the editor of the rest of the magazine besides the feature, sort of the front of the book stuff, editing the columns. And I loved it as far as that went. I loved editing. I loved working with writers. I loved coming up with ideas. Unfortunately, the best days of Upside were already past, which I quickly suspected and quickly saw. There was bad management at the company, to be honest. And also, I think just at that time, probably it was 97 when I left, but just at that time, you know, ad dollars were getting harder to get for these kind of magazines. And this didn't have any big publisher behind it, right? It was just independent. So it started going down, down, down. Meanwhile, I was there and I learned a lot, but I was increasingly interested in what was happening online, which was picking up. And so my love of content led me to the first of my online content jobs. I went to one of the first what were called interactive firms. And basically, this one was Studio Archetype. It had come out of Clement Mock Design. Clement and was an early designer at Apple. So Studio Archetype was one of the first sort of stops for a lot of brand names to get their first website. So everybody, all these companies now realized, oh, we have to have something on the web. And so it was like, you know, the biz dev guys basically were like taking phone calls because everybody needed this, and Studio Archetype had sort
and
of
crucially,
a premium product.
They need to find the people that know how to do this.
Like, yeah.
It's not you throw a rock on the street and you'll hit somebody that knows it.
No, that's
like,
right.
Who are the people that know what this online stuff even is?
That's right.
And how to do it.
And not all designers did, but there were a subset of designers, and this kind of new area of information architecture, as it was then called, was coming up. And that really interested me. Sort of, if you don't have page constraints, and how do you help people find information online, you know, and make it useful? I mean, I was thinking of that. I cared about that before I heard of Google, which is maybe good for me. I don't know. But I thought this is really an interesting area to learn about.
Yeah.
And so I joined that firm. First, I was head of the project management team who managed the client projects. And then moved into a role as head of the content people who were on the client teams.
Who are some of the clients that you're working with in those days?
Let's see. IBM, UPS, Realtor.com stands out. I don't remember a lot of retailers, although there probably were some.
And you think, again, today, you say, well, why doesn't IBM have their own team? Well, they might not. And they might not be able to identify the people that even in their organization would
That's
know
right.
how to do this sort of
That's
thing.
That's right. So. It was very new. And none of these sites, I'm sure, were in any way sophisticated, right? But Studio Archetype did have developers on staff as well as sort of what would now be front-end developers, you know, people who knew enough about coding to put something together. Very few companies had any kind of in-house resources, or if they did, they were technology companies that had no design shops.
Right. So all of those companies, like Organic
Vivid,
they either die when the bubble bursts, or they get sucked up into somebody else. And they what was the result?
So Studio Archetype got bought by Sapient, which was, you know, a systems integration firm.
Right.
And it did well for, it was smart of Sapient to buy a creative team. It was like pain for the creative people because we quickly learned, I mean, I hadn't known this before, you know, these systems integrators are like, we need four people with 5 years of C++ to go to Dallas for 3 months. Mm-hmm. Well, you can't really do that with creative people. In the same way, it's just not, you know, and it just it was a tough acquisition. Sapient made a lot of money out of it. Clement Mok did. And, you know, of my friends at Studio Archetype, only a few stuck it out at Sapient for any length of time, a few years at most. But all those other firms, Sapient, Scient, Viant, they all were doing the same thing.
Yeah, yeah. So we probably should start to head towards Google.
Yes.
But the way to get there that I found interesting is that, so just give me a little color, personal, anecdotal, of the bubble bursting, of everyone being out of work, because I think that this is, again, and we'll, believe me, we'll talk about your book, too, at some point here, too, but the way that you get to Google, and correct me if I'm wrong, is it is sort of like networking when everybody's out of work and everyone's looking for what's the next thing they can do, and so please.
Yes. So the bubble did burst in the Bay Area around 2000. I had left Studio Archetype to join a startup. The startup was called Violet.com. Mm. No N in Violet. Mm-hmm. It was an early online retailer similar to Red Envelope, which back then was its main competitor. Mm-hmm. They had $3 million in VC money, and two women had started it. One of them had a technical background. I was interested in a startup, and I would once again be executive producer of the content side. I'd been one of their early customers. I liked them. But my powers of prognostication failed me because after being there 4 months, the whole thing shut down because they couldn't get a second round of funding. Mm. They'd had a VC telling them, get big fast.
Right.
So they were an 18-person company talking about bus ads in New York.
Right. You've raised $3 million, spent $2 million on ads.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It was absurd. So anyway, they couldn't get a second round. So in April of 2000, they shut down. And I feel like it was the canary in the coal mine because not long after then, lots of things sort of halted or were shut or just suddenly nobody was hiring. Mm-hmm. That was the first time I'd seen in however many years I'd already been in the Bay Area. I mean, just nothing was happening. Mm-hmm. And
someone told me that like traffic... On the you could get
on the 101.
Get, the 101 suddenly you can get anywhere you want. There's no traffic jams.
It was pretty tough. And everybody I talked to, they didn't all lose jobs, but either they were hanging on to jobs or, you know, the ones they were interviewing for, we put those plans on hold, that kind of thing.
Right.
And so I started a support group for people who were. Like me, sort of looking for work, and we met to talk about our resumes and our elevator pitches and any contract work leads we had, that kind of thing. We did that for a while. And somewhere in there, I realized I need to call my old friend, Cindy, who I'd worked with at IDG.
Right.
She had recently left Apple to take a job with a startup called Google in 99. And... I visited her a couple times in Mountain View, and I knew about Google, and I had actually reviewed Google, the search engine for Computer Currents, or one of the publications I wrote for. And the striking thing about Google was it just worked.
It worked.
And the first 25 search engines had not just worked.
It's funny that you always have to underline that. Like, that was the thing, is that they literally did not work. I mean, you could find things on AltaVista and things... But this idea that I have any question that pops into my head, where was Tom Petty born? And boom, you can have an answer in 2 seconds, and it's going to be the right one.
Yeah.
That they cracked that, and that's a miracle.
Yeah, it really was. In fact, my one TED stage appearance was before Google. It had to be in 98. It was something they haven't done really since, but Werman wanted a panel about search engines that I moderated on stage. Google wasn't there, right? It was like Dogpile and Northern Light. And
was that the year that, what's his name, demoed GoTo?
Oh, yes, maybe.
Right.
Yes. I know who you mean.
Yeah, I do too.
Right,
which is an infamous one because he was almost hissed off the stage.
Sorry,
I interrupted.
Anyway, back to my friend Cindy, now at a startup called Google. You know, I got in touch with her, it was probably 2001. I mean, this thing went on for a while. It took probably the better part of a couple of years, I think, for the downturn to sort of turn mm-hmm. back. But anyway, I'd been in touch with her. I'd called her once, and she said, I said, do you need anybody? And she said, we just hired a marketing writer, but I'll let you know if you know, we need more. Well, a couple months later, she did call me back, and she said, we actually could use your help. Come down and meet the team, and just know that it's not my decision alone. Mm-hmm. You know, other people have to like you, and mm-hmm. I understood that. So I did go down, and I was really desperate for work at this point. I mean, I had bought a place, and I was scraping by. I was borrowing from my mom. It was, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It was not a good time.
So this is 2002, 2003, maybe?
Yeah.
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 Okay. So they're in the Plex at this point. And
they're not in the Plex. When okay. I first went, they were a little office park nearby okay. On Shoreline
right,
Boulevard
right, right,
in
right,
Mountain
right,
View.
Right, right.
But not quite the Plex yet.
Before they moved into the...
the Sun campus.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. So anyway, I went down September 3, 2002, I remember, met the team, and basically people were very nice and said, how soon can you, like, can you help with this op-ed? Can you help with this? Can you help with this? And I said, yes. And so I just signed up as an hourly employee, and my thought was, well, I'll mostly work from home. And within a couple weeks, I realized I need to be there. And I want to be there, and by the way, I want a job there mm-hmm. Because I loved what their mission was, and I thought, these are nice people, and I'm desperate, mm-hmm. all those things. So I just started commuting and plugging myself into everything I could get my hands on to.
So you're
on.
Not, because eventually your role is editorial director, but you're not brought on to be the editorial
no,
director.
No, no, it was like a marketing writer, and at that time... the team was called corporate marketing, so it included hardly any marketing, not at all like today. PR, translation, they were kind of all together in one team, and so I did some of the first customer, you know, sort of stories for AdWords when they came out, and the first AdWords newsletter for. I guess clients that were buying it, but I also did sort of commentaries by different engineers they were trying to profile, and I was a utility writer.
Without leading the witness, as it were, am I right to get the sense that maybe that this is still so early on in that company that you might be helping them learn how to do these things for the first time, like. These outreach, like you're describing, and PR outreach, but also like describing product and like user success stories and things like that.
Yes, because they didn't all. I mean, people had different backgrounds: product marketing people or product management people. You know, different people around the company had they had their own specific needs. I remember with the newsletter, for example, I went through, I swear, 26 versions of. Version of edition one because they kept wanting to put something else in it, and I kept saying, you know, a newsletter is a periodic. You're going to have more than one, like, let's ship this one and move on to the next one. And there were people who just didn't understand that sort of it's going to have a frequency to it. And so yes, I probably was bringing some sense of all I'd learned about kind of, you know, useful content and editorial rules of the road and that sort of thing.
So had they bought Pyra before you came on?
No. Okay. They hadn't, and when they did, I immediately enlisted a couple of colleagues on the PR team and said, this is what we should be using, Blogger, for corporate kind of output from the company, because Google was never really a press release type company. They didn't like them. They'd put out a handful, probably.
This is what I'm saying, them learning to be a grown-up company.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Go ahead.
And so there was no real objection to it. It was more about, well, how do we make it work? Because Blogger wasn't, on Google systems yet, and, you know, there's a whole kind of rebuild that you have to
do. Did you have experience with blogging yourself, personally?
No, but I knew about it.
Okay.
You know, I don't think I knew enough about what was happening, this whole sort of.
It was more that you, there were people journal. That you read rather than you had your own personal blog.
Yes, and I knew that this was an easier way to publish.
Uh-huh.
And so to me, that was the appeal, to have something be faster. And I thought, this reflects Google. Mm-hmm. So nobody objected. There wasn't a lot of understanding of how it would actually work. And in the beginning, it was painful to post because since it wasn't secure, mm-hmm. the blogger software, we had to go through a push, from the corporate system. So it went from blogger to the corporate system, and there would be delay. So we'd say, where's that post? And they'd be like, oh, we had a, we had a fail. We had to kind of redo, because it wasn't a direct sort of hit the button and publish system in the beginning. And I'm sure I bugged Jason Goldman and some of the blogger guys endlessly, because they weren't used to this either. They were used to, this is what you do on Blogger. Mm-hmm, you hit publish and it's live. And so here we had this clunky thing in the middle until eventually it was rebuilt, mm-hmm. According to Google standards. But it took a while to get the blogging machine up and going. But in the beginning, I became the guy who was nominally the marketing head was Doug Edwards, who left in 2005. So I then became, I inherited the sort of, and developed the process for publishing and doing it quickly. Mm-hmm. And that always worked amazingly well at Google. Many other companies had told me, we can't get through legal, we can't do this and that, but...
I'm going to ask about that in a second, because it does become the face of Google's not, but that sort of is the official Google blog, and adopting that as their way of communicating to the world, did a lot to shape people's perceptions of Google as being we're just sort of these open, we're just people just like you, and we want to do these great things, and was that already the culture, and then this was just a perfect channel for channeling that culture, or did that help shape how Google presented itself to the world?
Well, I think both. I think initially my thought had been, oh good, I'll get to run an editorial team. Mm-hmm. And no, that never really turned out to be true, because Google was already pretty flatly distributed as far as, the product manager takes center stage for the thing the product manager's in charge of, as opposed to being top down. Mm-hmm. Sergey and Larry weren't really interested in, they were certainly not interested in executive blogging. Mm-hmm. And I remember the blogger team at that time was the ones who had come in with the acquisition, were used to the idea that a blog is an individual voice. And they said to me originally, this it can't be corporate. Mm. And I said, it's just a publishing platform. It's not shaped, you can't determine that. It can be a company as well. But I think in their minds, they were thinking company equals PR voice.
Faceless, deniatorian.
Right. Yeah. And at Google, the notion, it was never said to me explicitly, but it was the product manager for, the product is the name that's going on the post. And in many cases, the product manager would at least draft the post, which I would encourage, because they were the subject matter experts.
Yeah, and this is what I'm trying to give credit to, is that is, again, has become common.
Yeah.
Although Steve Case did it at AOL, too, but he was the one, other people at AOL did it, too, but this idea that I'm going to sign my name to this post, I'm going to tell you about this product,
Right.
To this day, if changes are made at YouTube, I'm going to be the one that's going to announce it to the community and things like that.
Right, yeah. Right. It was a way of not being top down, and at the same time wanting to be informative again from, here's the person who knows or who led the initiative or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And that generally has held up, but I think increasingly important is the ability to quickly apologize, recognize there's an outage or something's gone wrong, we're looking into it. That became then a really key part of this that I think Google was always pretty much always on the right side of, in terms of acknowledging problem, we're going to say something, because the whole culture is speeding up around all this publishing stuff.
I just spoke to Matt Cutts a couple months ago here.
Oh, yeah,
so,
yeah.
I am the face of, I'm reaching out to the SEO community. And
And he was a wonderful example of an early Googler who knew how to do it, was very trustworthy. Nobody ever, he didn't show his blog to anybody in PR, and everybody trusted him.
Yeah.
Because he was amazing that way. He knew, he had just the right tone. But it was that sort of spirit that the blog was meant to also capture.
What about, because I saw the talk at Google that you did recently, I believe that the lawyers did have some issues around the time of the IPO.
The timing.
Yes.
Yes. Well, say everybody agreed is business as usual before an IPO. That's fine. So announcing a product that is already, you know, been acknowledged as existing, like no surprises essentially on a blog. But the thing was, the lawyers had agreed in principle to it, and then I think there was a little anxiety about, you know, this notion of a company having a blog was unusual, and then there were SEC, you know, concerns about this, and so they basically really slowed things down until the IPO. They didn't say no, but no blogging. They just said it absolutely has to be the most, you know, kind of anodyne. And that's why we had recipes from Charlie's Kitchen, you know.
Yeah.
In the beginning, it took a little bit. Probably the Playboy interview had some effect too.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about that.
Yeah.
So some of the other initiatives at Google, I think you the Zeitgeist you might have been involved with as well.
Oh my God! So in the early, this was something where I did learn from an engineer. So there had been, and this was one of those things I volunteered to pick up on, there had been some kind of intermittent, like, search trends on Google thing that had been published intermittently, or maybe it had been monthly, but it had fallen off because the person who did it wasn't around. I can't remember, but there was, it was like once a month. And so I offered to pick it up, or somebody said it would be good to pick up again. So I was introduced to employee number 8, who was a wonderful engineer named Amit Patel. And he was so great because he could explain to me a lot of things about how the index worked, about how what the significance of a search spike was as opposed to like everyday searches. So that's the simplest explanation for why you don't want, as part of any kind of trends, like weather. Because weather is a constant that people are searching for, right? But you want the things that have an unusual activity, and that tells you, like, what's unusual that's sort of, like,
bubbling to the surface.
Out of,
yeah.
And so in the very early days, I would get access to a super raw index of queries, super raw. And it was just a list of words with some numbers attached to each one that I didn't understand. I would print out, it worked out with Amit that I would print out like the first 50 pages and go through with a highlighter and like different colored pencils or something to try and come up with some interesting patterns. Like, I think these are music terms maybe, or this is something in the news, or, you know, it was really hard to determine what was what. But I'd go through it, show it to him, he'd explain how something was maybe not so much a spike, but I was trying to come up with little categories, and probably the Wayback Machine has some of these if you go back, because we did do it monthly, and it was based off of like literally a paper printout of the thing. It led eventually to what was called Google Zeitgeist, which eventually became, I guess, Google Trends, so that you could search for anything anywhere, because we were kind of limited by either English language, global, something like that, because it was just too hard to determine. And Google was already in at least 30 languages at that time, so it was really hard. Would have been hard to figure this out for all the languages around the world. But so we just started with English and kind of did trends about like popular culture and some news and politics that we could find to make
and
sense.
And then again, when you say, you know, this is our own internal data, but it might be interesting to people if we throw that out and show it to them as well.
Yeah.
And people are just like, yeah, sure, why not?
Yeah. Yeah. These were always, I mean, Google still, it was growing at, I'm sure, a very healthy clip, but it was ways to show like, here's the interesting stuff that Google search has aggregated, you know, tell us about what's going on, and led not too long after that to, like, Google flu trends, for example, and other things.
Before we leave Google, that made me think of a question I should have asked earlier. Did you ever, were you ever able to, maybe Larry and Sergey themselves or whoever, were you ever able to sit down with someone and be like, explain to me, articulate to me Google's values as a company and what we're, what the face is we want to show the world?
I felt like I absorbed that. I don't, I mean, maybe because I was there early enough, it was already, Don't Be Evil was already established. Actually, it was something that Amit had, you know, kind of been part of. I felt I understood it. And it wasn't, the interest was not, how do we show ourselves to the world? It's sort of like, I mean, people felt like they were on a mission, and it was a good mission, and they had passion for it. And it was about all the world's information and to make things useful and to improve the world, improve society, improve, you know, how people learned and, you know, did other things in the world because of what they had been able to learn or access or get through Google or do through Google. I felt like I just absorbed that, and I felt like I understood it, and it probably, it worked because it's made me more or less a Google loyalist, even to today. So I grieve when I see mistakes happening, but you know, or you know, concerning things. But I think, at the end of the day, those things are going to prevail, which may be wrong. But
maybe we'll come back and talk about a little bit about that in the end.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery.
Getting us to Twitter, you launched the first Google Twitter account, official Google Twitter account?
I did. So I was still at Google.
Right.
This was 2009.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah.
And I'd been keeping an eye on, I mean, I knew the guys who'd been at Blogger, who left Google, who went to eventually start Twitter. And I thought, at first I thought, this is just these guys talking about, I'm downtown, where are you? But I kept an eye on it because, again, it's another interesting publishing platform. And by 2009, I thought there were a lot of tech reporters already using it, as you might expect. And so from my vantage point on the Google comms team, I felt like Google should be there because it's a techie thing. The tech reporters are there. And Google has kind of a reputation as a techie place. Like, I had done a couple of the Talk Like a Pirate Day posts for Google.
Yeah.
This was just part of tech culture at the time. And so I had to make the case to my colleagues on the comms team. They weren't all sold on the idea. You know, they felt like by now, we have enough channels. We don't really need another channel. And I explained about the reporters, and then the argument was, we don't have headcount. I said, you don't need headcount. I can do it. You know, this isn't a 24/7 job. Especially then, and so they trusted me enough to run it. Biz Stone had reserved at Google. You know, they'd whitelisted a bunch names for us. So I worked with him or his team to, you know, get it transferred over, whatever, so that I had access to it. And then I just, you know, by then I'd been at Google long enough. I knew. I took it very seriously. It was not going to make any... There was no personal stuff, of course. It was all about reflecting Google and going a little bit, but not too far beyond what was being posted. So it was sort of, you know...
Reinforcing.
Yeah, amplifying. Yeah,
amplifying.
And then, you know, occasionally there would be... It was sort of I had to do the rule, make up the rules along the way, but I just was very careful about not making any mistakes. And within... you know, I don't know, a few days, we had a million followers. And so then people began to understand, okay, it's we're reaching maybe some of the same people and some different people. And then that led to a proliferation of Google Twitter accounts. Mm-hmm. So that I basically managed the process for that sort of mm-hmm. thing, not all the accounts.
So how and why do you go to Twitter?
By 2011, I wasn't really doing much new at Google. I was kind of in the same job. And a number of my friends had left. And although I always thought, this is where I'm going to, like, end my career, I also, you know, I thought, well, maybe I'm not, you know. But I mean, maybe there's other things that are interesting. Twitter was now more interesting to me, in part, to be honest, because the founding team had stepped away.
Yeah. Is that period when they've all
gone.
Left. Yeah.
I they were nice guys.
Yeah.
I hadn't known Jack, but uh-huh. I'd known Biz and Ev. And they were nice guys, but I didn't really think they could really manage a company that was growing. They weren't executives. I mean,
right.
they didn't have business side management. So that had changed, and there was a COO and a CEO, Dick Costolo, mm-hmm. had come in, and Ali Raghani was there. So it was professionalizing and, you know, kind of cleaning up from the early startup days. So it did interest me, and I did get hired there as an editorial director. Similar kind of role, but so different at Twitter because they hadn't had a happy story to tell. They didn't have like constant run of products and product stories like Google had. They'd been avoiding talking about anything for a while. They'd had kind of a troubled ride. And after Biz, they didn't have a kind of a name or a face. So they were used to everything being signed the Twitter team. And I remember Jack asked me what I thought of that, and I said, it's tantamount to being anonymous.
Right.
It just...
Well, and so doesn't make sense for the product that everyone else is using the way that they're using it.
Individually, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, so it was a little more of a struggle to get established there because of many reasons. People were not used to the idea of individual signers on post. It took longer to sort of get my hands around it. And I never really could get my hands around at Twitter, the Twitter account, because again, for a long time, it had been very conservative. It was hard to be cheeky or jokey or anything on the platform because it would get misinterpreted so easily. Not for today's political reasons,
right.
but just for, you know, language and culture reasons.
Character count reasons. It's
yes,
harder to
that
be.
Too.
It's harder
yeah.
to be nuanced in the with the character limits.
Yes, exactly. And then at the time it was 140.
Yeah.
And you know, links and maybe not images, but images weren't common in even those days in 2011.
Do you evolve? Every time I've asked you, were you involved in early blogging? Were you like I've known you of you for years because of your Twitter account, and,
uh-huh.
and we'll get into eventually how you're a networking and connector person.
Right.
But did you evolve into that at Twitter, or is that something that you started to do? I'm saying Karen putting yourself.
Oh yeah.
As a public face, when did that begin to happen?
That probably was through the Twitter account, which I had started very slowly, I think, and also 2009.
Mm-hmm.
But while I was running at Google, you know, I started to just experiment more myself with my own account, KBox, and just Google wasn't particularly fussy at that time about personal accounts. I mean, I don't think necessarily they still are. I helped write the employee communication guidelines
mm-hmm.
at Google, and in those days it was more about one's personal blog mm-hmm. than it was social. But in any case, I was familiar with what kind of the requirements were. But I, you know, the further I went, and probably going to Twitter really kind of helped encourage that because people at Twitter were encouraged, of course, to have their own Twitter accounts. And the free expression wing of the Free Expression Party or whatever the the phrase was then was in full flower, mm-hmm. you know. So again, I wasn't worried about going really out of bounds, but I thought, I have been around long enough now, and, you know, people kind of know me, and I can swing out a little bit here. I mean, I'm not going to hide my, you know, political biases and that sort of thing.
Well, you know, I watched several interviews with you and stuff to prepare for this, and you know, talked to Cindy and other people that know you about this. Time and time again, it comes up over and over that you're an introvert, described by others. And so the idea that you have made this name and reputation for yourself as I'm a connector and a communicator, that didn't come naturally to you? Is that something that you had to consciously evolve yourself into, or?
No, I mean, to me, being a communicator is about, it took the form of writing. Mm. And being online, you're behind a screen.
Yeah.
And so to me, these things were all compatible. Mm. I mean, I was networked with a lot of people because of the internet. And I was, you know, one's writing, not just mine, could reach so many more people than the days of magazines, you know. As long as an introvert, I should also say, is not a shy person.
Right.
Necessarily. An introvert just needs kind of time and space to think away from the crowd and away from the daily crush of business.
Being in a crowd can suck energy from an introvert.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, that's right.
And you have to recharge alone sometimes.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's it, exactly. And so, to me, I can go out in the fray, you know, with the best of them, but, mm-hmm. you know, then I just need to sort of withdraw and kind of ponder everything before I go back out. So, no, there was no conflict at all. And in fact, I would not have the network I have or the reach I have or the awareness or the anything if it weren't for being online for
right.
so long.
It also strikes me, and I think it was your interviewer at the talk at Google that pointed this out as well, that your job has always been to go to these companies and make them extroverts to a certain degree.
Uh-huh.
And like Google, those are founders that are not extroverts.
Right.
Twitter,
right.
You were just describing that was a company that... So again, being an introvert, your job and your career has been to pull people out into the limelight a bit. And
those who want to go,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of like, and I would say this because I have done a lot of consulting with businesses that want to be, these days the term is thought leaders, right?
Right.
They want to be in the conversation. That's another phrase.
Yeah.
That's all good as long as the people you have representing you want to do it and have some facility at doing it. You can't drag the ones who are resistant to it out in front and say, you're going to be our main blogger or you're going to be our name on everything. That's not going to work. So you have to have willing participants who are willing to put themselves out.
Well, I also want to encourage, for the last several years, Karen has been writing great stuff for Back Channel, Stephen Levy's Back Channel. While that existed. Do you have a regular outlet today like that?
I don't. I mean, I'm delinquent in writing some stuff up on my own Medium.
I was going to say, but by the way, there exists a great library of the last several years of great things that you've written about. But let's talk about the book, which came out a couple months ago.
Mm-hmm.
It's called Taking the Work Out of Networking. Just real briefly, where did the idea to do this book come from? And again, I know you as this connector who knows everyone in tech and things like that. Is the idea to tell people how to be a connector like you, or?
Yes, it is partly that. So the book came about, I had written one of my Back Channel stories a while back was about building a network for life. I think I called it something like that. And you know, cycles went by, and I talked to a New York editor, which led me to get an introduction to an agent, which led to a book proposal. And the idea was, initially, I thought it would be like networking for introverts.
Mm-hmm.
There are several books on that topic, actually, quite a few. And so the thing that I realized was I'd like to try to break down in some detail the way I go about both meeting new people and keeping up with people mm-hmm. I know even slightly, because it really is a bunch of tactics that anybody can do. And in my experience, it's very enriching, gives you a broader worldview. You have serendipitous conversations. Things unfold because of who you're talking to about at any given time. And so let me see if I can kind of document that for other people, because it's very enriching, and we're living in a world where we're going to have to constantly make connections and then keep them.
Well, and that's one of the interesting things, I think, is that it's also a guide to this modern, there's all of these tools now and all of these platforms and all of these networks. It's not just, well, I'll have a LinkedIn profile and that's my networking done.
Right.
Like, it's how the various strategies of making these things actually be valuable for you, these tools. And even to the sense of the different strategies, like, don't be someone that goes out and, you know, comments on everything and shares every little detail.
You don't have to do that.
Like, how you can contribute and take from your networking activities in meaningful ways.
Yeah. It's just an ecosystem. And I still use the word web. I mean, it is a virtual web of connections, and we can have more than we could ever have in the physical world. And we can maintain, you know, a wonderful set of relationships. And maybe this actually reflects some of my longstanding love of Google. You know, we can each, like, help make information accessible to each other.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like, you're not going to get the perfect answer for any question from one individual person. You're going to piece together a bunch of search queries,
mm-hmm.
and you're going to find that one conversation leads you to somebody else that leads you to something else, and that's how you sort of make your way, and that's how we have to make our way in the world today, because our worlds are much more fluid than they used to be.
The quote, I'm going to get close to it. I think one of your favorite quotes in the book is that networking is less like hunting and more like farming or gardening.
Yeah.
What's the idea there?
Yeah. Well, so hunting, we must say, is pretty transactional.
Right.
You know, sort of.
Sort of zero sum a bit.
Yeah. And that's how people, I think of networking that they hate, is that I've got to go into this room, I've got to, or the ballroom or the conference, and I've got to, like, go find the perfect person, make my pitch, you know, get the answer I want, and, you know, and that's the end of it. Where farming or gardening are both very, depending on the scale you want to think about, very seasonal, you know, ongoing. You're planting, you're weeding, you're thinning, you're trimming, you're replacing, you know, something, you're replanting in a different location. You're doing all those things constantly, and that's what you're doing with
there's no expectation of immediate reward either.
No, that's right.
Exactly.
That's right.
It's more of an investment as well.
Yeah, that's right.
Again, the book is Taking the Work Out of Networking. I recommend people buy it. If final few questions to the degree that you're willing, then I'm going to ask you to comment from your point of view.
Mm-hmm.
Twitter, you haven't been there for how many years now?
Three, yeah.
Twitter.
This will be three.
Twitter, in the sense that people like to argue and debate about it as this sort of platform that is so fascinating and so valuable to so many people. I use nothing as much as I use Twitter, right? But then at the same time, it's this fraught with all sorts of problems.
Right.
Do you feel like Twitter's always going to be stuck in the mode that it's in, and it's either you have to develop tactics to use Twitter effectively that are not harmful for you personally, or do you think that Twitter is ever going to be capable as a company to evolving to something that will be maybe a little more sophisticated as a product? That's a super general, broad question. I'm basically asking, do we think Twitter will ever get better?
It will ever get better. I want to say yes, and I would say that for probably lots of people, Twitter is already fine if they're following, sports or cats or music or something that is not caught up so directly in the world of politics and, you know,
whatever the
daily
hot
news.
Issues,
yes, the hot button stuff. It probably is fine for that. And what's fascinating about Twitter and complex too is it's who you're following mm-hmm. that determines yeah. what you're seeing.
Exactly.
And so, you know, those of us who are like news hounds, like, okay, we're following too much and we've caught up in like every outrage of the moment. But you don't have to be. It's just that's now the popular conception of what yeah. Twitter is. The other interesting thing is I feel like some of the abuse issues they have not maybe resolved, but improved reporting, mm-hmm. improved probably some of the catching like bad intent accounts mm-hmm. coming in, mm-hmm. things that they probably aren't going to talk about as right. as openly. But it seems to me that fewer public complaints are going on. It doesn't mean, I mean, Twitter, like you know, any commenting system
right.
is going to have like
at that
bad
scale
behavior.
At that scale it's impossible yeah. to be perfect, right?
It's going to have bad behavior, and there's a lot of misunderstanding about their general guidelines, which I don't think are perfect by any means, but for a long time it was, if you're saying nasty things about someone, you know, then you should be reported and off the system. And I used to have to explain to people, that's not a direct enough threat according to Twitter rules, right? That it used to be, and again, I think this is probably changing, that you have to say, like, you know, here's your phone number, here's your street address, I'm coming to you to attack you, mm-hmm. right? Okay, that's direct enough for Twitter. I believe that they're having to take a look at this because they did kick off Milo mm-hmm. For not doing that directly, but saying to his followers.
Exactly.
You know, so there's a little more gray area there than I think. I mean, for me, Twitter is still a very unique platform. It does not have a direct competitor. It is, I mean, I have to say, I guess, addicted to the sort of real-time notion of it, not for the outrage, but just what are people talking about right now? What's going on in the world? That's what I do like about it mm-hmm. and do look to it for. And it can be a funny thing as well as
yeah.
an outrage.
Yeah, yeah. All right, here's another one that I don't even know how to frame into a question. So let me just say what I want to say and then we'll see if I can find a question. a friend of mine that has worked at both Facebook and Google, when the walkouts at Google
yeah.
happen, and this person says, of course that happens at Google, and sadly, that's never going to happen at Facebook, which is a comment about the different cultures.
Yeah.
So number one, here's how I'll frame it. Number one, are you not surprised at all that it's Googlers that are the ones that are like, when there's something rotten in this company, we're going to stand up and fix it ourselves? Are you not at all surprised?
Not surprised. Not surprised.
Then my question would be, and again, to the extent that you would want to comment on this, do you have a sense, again from Googlers that I know, that perhaps the management culture has changed, but the rank and file culture is still the don't be evil, and there is increasingly a disconnect there?
I don't know that. I don't feel like it's that clear cut.
Okay.
Partly because I don't know how a culture kind of coheres when it's 85 or 90,000 people. I mean, maybe they do at Disney in some way. I don't know, but I don't know how many people care about the early days or the Don't Be Evil necessarily. Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful legacy and kind of folktale,
right?
In a way, I don't know how much that governs things. Although there is something there, because I agree with your friend who commented. I do think it was Googlers who had a quite effective and wonderful walkout. I actually mm-hmm. knew one of the people behind it, and I wrote her a note and I said, good for you. You know, this really worked well. But a change in, I don't see it as a change in management. If you recall, there was a lot of internal discussion earlier when Google was debating its relationship to China mm-hmm. a couple of times.
Right.
And internal dissent and people on both sides. It wasn't like the management was all one way and everybody was the rank and file was the other way. There were people on both sides, and I think they came to the right decision. And now, according to The Intercept, I think they've come to the right decision again. Mm-hmm. I just think it's... I understand there's a big market in China, yeah. but I just think it's just too risky a road if you have had these scruples all this time.
Well, and you know, maybe that's what it is that it's not just Google. It is, I won't name names. The quote someone said to me was, I signed up to organize the world's information. Here, let's pull that. Oh, yep, sorry. I signed up to organize the world's information, and now my engineering work might be used for drone attacks. And so maybe right. it's all of tech where as we move into the AI and things like this, it's like, well, he said, I feel like I was sold a bill of goods. And so, but maybe that's just the nature of where tech is going all over the place now.
Yeah, I don't think it's like the management had an evil purpose and hid it from you mm-hmm. when you were being hired mm-hmm. as much as everything is evolving. That's what's so interesting about this kind of newfound interest in studying ethics mm-hmm. in relation to product development and right. technology. I'm all for that. That should be much more for engineers, for lawyers, for product managers, for everybody. Let's like think these things through, because we haven't had a time, until recently when the global scale of these, not just the companies, but the mm-hmm. technologies, mm-hmm. has had so many implications,
right?
And so many unintended consequences. So I just don't, it's not as simple as
right.
the management of a company.
I always wish I could find who said this, because I've used it a lot now on the Tech Meme Show or whatever, but someone said recently that computer science has never had its, in physics, we had the atom bomb happen, and so everyone had to, as a profession, physicists had to come to terms with what they could do.
Yes.
We have a Nobel Prize because chemists had this moment where they realized, look at what our science can do. And it's almost like we're in the moment where computer scientists have to have that moment of reckoning where this coding in a room could blow up the world somehow. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
and it's like,
yeah.
that's the moment that
it's a good
we're
analogy.
Reckoning with right
yeah.
now.
Yeah, I think so. And I think... not just for the bad actors, but also, as we're seeing on the advertising side, mm-hmm. sort of the unintended consequences of the linking of products and advertising and the ads following you around online and following you offline and, mm-hmm. All the rest of it. I don't know that... I'm sure most people, even in the leadership positions, did not think through sort of the adoption of the mobile phone, mm-hmm. right, and the ubiquity of online services and just the importance of that. I don't think people envision quite the scale. And then add to that the sort of connectedness of people. Mm-hmm. I don't think Facebook understood at all that there could be a downside to the world being connected, or whatever their slogan is. So, yeah, these are all things that they just didn't exist before. And nobody, I do think, understood the possibility, just as we didn't understand the possibility of someone flying a plane into a building. Mm-hmm. I don't think anybody at any of these companies thought, oh, bad actors are going to legitimately use our advertising platforms in these ways. I mean... Now it seems, of course, that could happen and will happen.
Well, you did spend 5 years telling people buying those ads how effective they were, so Kel shocked that they're actually effective.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So no bad actors, they don't advertise, right? They hack.
Right,
that
right.
That was the notion for a long time.
Yeah. Karen, I'm going to wrap it up there. Let me just thank you for such a wide-ranging conversation about your career, but about all of this stuff generally.
Oh, it's so much fun to talk about this. Thank you, Brian.
If you like what you've heard on this episode, please support us by subscribing to the podcast so you can get great news stories and conversations every 2 weeks. And please buy the book that was based on this podcast, How the Internet Happened, From Netscape to the iPhone, by me, Brian McCullough. Order it now wherever books are sold. How the Internet Happened. And if you weren't aware, I host a daily tech news podcast every weekday that comes out at 5 p.m. In that show, I tell you what happened that day in the world of tech. It's only 15 to 20 minutes long, and it's great if you love tech news. Search your podcast app for Ride Home to find the show. It's called The Tech Meme Ride Home. Thanks.